Hello, we're going to talk to Advocate Debbie Ainslie about the subject of curators. Now, the first thing I'm going to ask her to explain to us, what is a curator, when does it get appointed, and when does it apply?
Hello, Henk. Big topic just right off the bat. Okay, so basically a curator is a custodian. It's a person who looks after something. Most common one is you would talk about a curator of an art exhibition or a museum or something like that would be a curator. In law, we have three different types of curators. We've got an ad litem, a curator a bonus, and a curator persona, and they have different roles and different responsibilities and powers, if you like. Okay, so the first one.
Now you use Latin terms. You need to translate that into English.
Okay, so curator ad litem is your curator in litigation, in law, ad litem. Ad is at or in, and then litem is just litigation in law. So a curator ad litem is representing a person in law, but is speaking for them. So unlike, if you have an attorney has your power of attorney, you are the principal, and the attorney can only do what you say that they can do. They're creatures of instruction, and you give instructions about what you want, what you want to claim. You get legal advice from them, but you are the principal and the attorney's the agent and has to act. In the case of a curator ad litem, it's a curator ad litem is appointed when the person doesn't have the capacity to act. So that would be, for example, that you might be appointed as a curator ad litem for children in a matter involving them, for example, custody matter or sexual abuse or criminal matters regarding where children are involved. It could be where someone has dementia, so a lot of old people, as they get older, they get dementia, they're no longer able to look after themselves. You would be appointed by the court as a curator ad litem to do the investigation, to check, are they able to still make decisions, are they able to take care of their own affairs, and should somebody be appointed to look after. A third example would be where I have acted as curator ad litem is in road accident fund matters, RAF, matters where the person has suffered a brain injury. So they're not demented, and they're not children, normally young adults or something, but they've got some sort of brain injury that would make it dangerous for them to be handling their own payout. And so as curator ad litem, I'll have to determine, is that the case based on the reports of specialist doctors and neurologists and psychiatrists and so on, and then deciding how to go forward then. So if I say, okay, this person cannot manage a big payout, and will not be able to provide for themselves for the rest of their lives from this payout because they don't have the frontal lobes or whatever to see the long term, whatever the brain damage is, and then got to say how this money needs to be protected for their lifetimes. And that gets us to the second type of curator, which is a curator bonus. A bonus is your estate, so it's somebody who's looking after your money, your home, your stuff, your financial stuff, your estate. So a curator bonus will be making decisions about whether your house needs to be sold to pay for your care, or whether in the case of the RAF matters, it would be, if you buy this new house, then how do we, you're not going to have money to live in it in 5 years' time, or we have to take this portion of the money out because actually we need to modify your house so that we can have it wheelchair, so the wheelchair can get in, you need a special bath, whatever. So they will look at how much money is there and how to spend it for the benefit of the patient or the person who's protected. The last one is a curator persona. Now, this is generally where somebody is not able to care for themselves, and you will the curator persona has to make decisions as to medical treatments, and they're actually, it's a persona being the person themselves. So you're now not looking after the person's money, but themselves. And you get appointed to do that. So obviously, if you're looking after the person and you're saying, okay, this person needs medical attention, then obviously you have to go to the curator bonus to release the funds to allow you to look after the person properly.
Okay, I'm going to stop there.
Yeah.
It sounds like the lawyer has to be a curator, but can a family member be a curator?
So the curator ad litem is normally an advocate in most matters. Can be an attorney as well. Curator bonus is often a family member, often the person who's been nominated in a will to be an executor, or one of the children or whatever of an elderly person, and then the persona we mostly will tie the persona and the bonus into one person, so the person who's got the purse strings is also the person looking after. What's happened in these days, where the children have gone overseas or whatever, they might still be the curator bonus handling their parents' money, but they need to have somebody here who is actually making sure the person is cared for. So that can be three different people. The ad litem appointment is just an investigation and recommendation role, and it isn't enduring. So once you've made your report and the curator bonus and or persona is appointed, then your role as ad litem, curator ad litem, is complete in those cases of dementia and everything. And the same when it's a matter involving children, it's once the court has decided, your role is completed. There's normally it's got to be somebody independent. So mostly for these matters, you would write, for example, to the Bar Council, and they ask them for possible names as a curator ad litem. You then approach that advocate and say, would you be able to do it? Will you be prepared to do it? This is the case. And then they consent to it. It goes to court. The court checks whether that they're happy with that appointment of that particular curator ad litem. And then you go about and do your thing and do your reports, which you report back to the court. And then it goes back to court for under the supervision of the master. The master of the High Court also has to write a report based on the curator ad litem's report, and then you go back to court for the appointment of a bonus and persona.
Okay, I'm gonna try and simplify this.
Mm-hmm.
And let's pick someone who's got dementia. It could also be a child, but let's stay with an adult for the time being. This person has got clearly cannot look after themselves. They're irresponsible with their money. They wander around the streets. They leave the home. They don't know where they are, and so they obviously need care. If a lawyer is the curator, the lawyer is not there all the time. The lawyer does not live in the house, doesn't make sure that this person feeds and cleans himself and doesn't wander around. So you need a family member or someone who lives with that person to be in some curator role. But you also need a lawyer to have this person appointed as some kind of curator, correct?
Yeah, so it's a legal process, so you need legal representation to go to court. You actually can appear in person, but there are requirements on it. So as I mentioned, the requirements for the curator ad litem appointment, there's requirements that have got to be met even in the application is that you need two reports from an alienist, and an alienist is a psychiatrist. So there has to be, before you even get the curator ad litem appointed, you have to have two reports from a psychiatrist saying that this person has dementia. The reason for this is even the curator ad litem appointment, which is the least intrusive, is still intrusive on a person's human rights. All their rights, the bundle of rights that they contain. I mean, it's invasion of their privacy, their dignity, their self-regulation. You know, what they want to do with their own lives or whatever. So there's the first protection and the appointment of the curator ad litem. And obviously the curator ad litem is the protection for a curator bonus. Now that curator bonus, as I said, doesn't have to be an attorney. Attorneys do that take on that role. And it is more hands-off than if it had been a family member who was appointed as curator bonus. But no matter who that appointment is, it's going to be from the master's office. The curator persona is the person who often is the same as the curator bonus, but is the person who is, it doesn't have to be the nurse who's looking after the person. In fact, you wouldn't want that to be. You want somebody who's got the oversight to see if this person is being looked after and to make those sort of decisions, you know, be it medical or... that she's got to go to the hairdresser now. One of the curator's persona was fighting because the bonus wouldn't allow her to have the patient go and have her hair done every 2 weeks.
Okay, so the person's rights really are invaded.
Totally infringed, yes.
Totally infringed. And then someone else takes over life decisions for them, just about everything.
Yeah, so there's got to be protections in there for that. I wasn't involved in this case, but there was an interesting case where a fellow who was enormously wealthy and had started, I can't remember which business it was, but it was like a chain store business, and his children brought an application for appointment of a curator bonus, and it was rejected because he stood up and argued the matter himself in court to say there's nothing wrong with him, they just don't like the fact that his new wife is spending all his money that they thought they were going to inherit. And the court, so that didn't even get past the curator ad litem stage. Like, it was like, absolutely not, I will not have this. That's the court has to decide that. So the curator, the independence of the curator ad litem is very important. I can't be appointed as a curator ad litem to a family member or a friend, or you can't do that just on, you know, it's got to be someone who's independent.
Totally independent, correct.
But then the curator bonus can be a family member or a friend. And often we don't ask for a curator persona at all. Person might be in a old age home or something. They don't need a curator persona. There's enough nurses and everything who will just report to the family, whether the curator bonus or any other, you know.
Okay, but now the person who becomes that curator bonus, or if I got the term correct, now takes control of, let's say I'm the guy who's now being curated. He takes over my life decisions, my hourly decisions, my money, everything, correct?
Not really your life decisions or your hourly decisions, but all your money, yeah. So in a way, I suppose life, because if the person who's been appointed as a curator bonus looks at your estate and says, okay, this is how much money you've got, the place that you're currently staying in, the old age home that you're staying in now, is I'm not going to be able to, even if I sell your house and your car and everything, I'm not going to be able to keep you in that care. Might look around for a cheaper alternative, and then they will make that decision, but it's based on the money, not on the whether the place is looking after you well or not.
Now, how is that curator controlled? Because obviously now I've got, the curator's now got control of someone else's money. and
Yes.
can spend it in whatever way they see fit.
Well, only on the patient. It is okay. Firstly, it's when in the appointment of the curator ad litem, who makes the recommendation about the curator bonus, the master's office, the master of the High Court, has to write a report to the court as well, and then every decision that the curator bonus makes regarding that estate, and the first thing they have to do is a full inventory to the master on when they are appointed, and then every decision they make regarding that estate has to be reported to the master's office, and they have to account for it. Also, there is, if it's an attorney, for example, there is no ways that security will be waived. Now, security is basically an insurance policy, and it is it used to be that you could put the house or, you know, immovable property, but now it's literally an insurance policy. Based on the value of the estate, the master determines how much security you have to put up, and if you steal from that estate, it is covered by that security, that policy. You can pay for the premiums of the policy from the estate, but when, if you steal money from the estate and you can't account for it, that's what that security is there for. So the security will match the value of the will be similar to the estate, but it's determined by the master on a number of factors, not just the value of the estate. So you can, the only way that you don't pay security is if the court orders that it be waived, and the court will only do so in exceptional circumstances. So let's have a look at what is exceptional circumstances. Exceptional circumstances could be, for example, that the patient's entire pension is used for their care and they have no other assets. If you lump a security premium on top of that as well, then they're not going to be able to care for the patient, and it will be a family member in that case, not an attorney. It'll be a family member. One of the things that we look at is that family member also in the person's will? If they were nominated as the executor in a will, which happens most frequently, then, and does the will waive security? Because you can waive security with the master in your will and say the master doesn't need security. If you leave that out of your will, the master will the master controls the estate of deceased estates as well as the in curator bonuses, and so the court will say, okay, these are exceptional circumstances, and the court decides that security is being waived, and that relies a lot on the curator ad litem's investigation and to make sure the appropriateness of the curator bonus before that security is waived, and the circumstances have to be exceptional. As mentioned, yeah.
Okay, we talked about adults, someone with dementia or something. Now, imagine I die, and my son is now 12 years old, and I need someone to manage his money until he's of age. Does that mean we appoint a curator?
It's possible, but normally the parents would create a trust in the will. If there's like a policy or something like that, it's easier managed by trust than curator. But if there's no provision for that, it would go into the guardian fund, which is also run by the master. And then whoever's looking after him would go and apply to the guardian fund for the money as needed. It's quite tedious, but it is a way of protecting the child's the child's inheritance. So that would sit in the guardian fund. So if you were sick, you could probably, before you died, I would do a trust. The trusts are still also overseen by the master's office. You can't act as a trustee until the master you've got the letter of appointment, the same as curator and the same curator bonus, and the same for an executor. You can only take any action once the master has appointed you, and the master looks at other things like security and inventories and things like that. And okay. then you have to account to the master. And the master is well able to sue you if, the, if for example, the curator ad litem had recommended that security is waived, and then you mishandle that estate and you use it for your own benefit. You can, it can be recovered. Even though you haven't, even though there's no insurance, they will. You spend the rest of your life paying back the person's money that you stole.
Okay, but so underage child is not necessarily a curator, a subject for curatorship.
Not necessarily. No.
Okay. So give me other examples of people who might be subject to curatorship.
Okay, so the brain injured people, so they just also lack the ability to manage their own money. In a couple of my RAF matters, I have suggested rather than a curator bonus, that a family member be appointed as a trustee along with others, and you form a trust, and that trust is managing that money, and it needs the consensus of everyone. So that way, we're protecting the family member from having to make like really hard decisions on. Often it's very poor people, they've got other children starving, whatever, but this money is paid out for this person's lifetime because they'll never be able to work, for example. That's a very hard call to make. Do I watch my children starving, or do I use his money? And so by being a trustee, we're getting somebody who knows the situation, who knows what's happening in the home, who knows what the needs are, who's got a voice at the table without having to take responsibility for that. But so that person would have had a curator ad litem appointed who then did the investigation and then made a recommendation to the court. That money can go into a trust fund or it can be managed by a curator bonus. Now, attorneys do that role as of curator bonus often, and a lot of them do it very well. There are limitations on how many they can take at any one point. I think you can't take more than five. You can't be managing more than five people's estates. But also, I've had circumstances where the brain injury is not apparent to the patient, and he believes that he should be able to go and buy that farm and go and do this and go do that, but he doesn't understand that he can't, he doesn't stay with anything. So in the 3 years I was working on that matter, every 6 weeks it was like he's found the solution, this is where he's going to be, and then he puts roots down and 6 weeks later you phone and he's gone somewhere else and he's done something else. So in his case, he doesn't understand that he has this problem, and he's very demanding, and you do not want to put that on one individual. So for him, we've also set up a trust with a family member as a trustee as well, and so he will be able to give direction of what he needs and everything. But the trustee's job then is to ensure that this money is going to last a lifetime while also caring for his current needs. Mostly,
yeah,
I
know a person exactly like that. But yeah, carry on.
Okay, that's a very typical thing with head injuries. So in that case, he doesn't have a curator persona. There's no need for that. He's compass mentis enough to look after himself in that regard. He just, and we haven't gone with a curator bonus. We've gone with a trust. Trustees can't be fired by him or anything. He's just a beneficiary of the trust. He doesn't get to make any decisions. And the trustees in this particular case, in fact, in a couple of the trusts that we formed, we've got an accountant, an attorney, and a family member. Those are the three trustees. And that accountant is often somebody who's got an investment in portfolio experience, investments, because you want to take that money and invest it and try and hope that he can live off the interest so that you're not going into the capital, because there's not enough to last a lifetime, but this person will never be able to hold down a job. Well, not more than 2 weeks anyway. So that's all the curator options. But one of the things I must mention, and people even experienced lawyers forget that where there's no estate of value, because you have to actually, before you make the first application to court, you have to give some indication of what your understanding of the value of the estate is. The curator ad litem will then do the further investigation. But where there's nothing, there's no substantial estate, and you have a person with dementia or a brain injury, and this often happens with people who are mentally handicapped, born that way, and their mothers are getting the SASSA grant, and then they become 18, so they're no longer getting the child grant. They need to know, or when SASSA made changes, you can apply to the master directly without any court proceedings or anything for the appointment as an administrator of somebody's estate. And that would be typically their estate cannot exceed 250,000, and that's typically your SASSA grant recipients, whether it's the disability or even just a child grant, but then you have to convert it to a disability. It allows the administrator under the Mental Health Act to get medical records and make applications on your behalf, open a bank account and all of that. So you're still administering the estate, but the estate is very modest. It doesn't require the same level of protection.
Okay, I'm still looking for another example, because we keep talking about people with adults with mental disability.
Okay, so let's talk about the other appointment. I was a curator ad litem for children. So so in that case, it's a very different role, and there's no curator bonus or curator persona who's going to come into the picture. What it is you are acting as a carer, as a curator for a child, typically in a dispute between parents. So if there's a what used to be called custody dispute, and this the mom says no, that the dad is awful and the kids can't stay with him, he's an alcoholic and he's drunk every night, and he's saying no, but she's bipolar and schizophrenic, and these are normal allegations, just by the way. And the court is required in the Constitution. There's actually a section that says the best interests of the children are paramount. In the Children's Act, that same provision is repeated again, but it also has another one that says that a voice of the child must be heard. If a child's of sufficient maturity, look at 10 years old, and are they mature enough? Or they don't even have to be 10 years, they can be younger than 10. Or if they're mature enough to understand and voice their opinions on things. So you can get that, the voice of the child. You can go to the family advocate, and the child gets interviewed, and they can express their opinion. And it also provides in the Children's Act that a child, a legal representative must be appointed for the child if it's required for the matter. Legal representative takes instructions. So legal representative is definitely going to give voice to the child's desires and wishes, because that legal representative has to act on the instructions of the child. There's a little bit of a problem with that, but that is what its role is. With a curator ad litem, you're a court-appointed person, so you're not appointed by the child and you're not appointed by either of the parents. Again, the independence is quite important. And you then do a investigation, including, and very importantly, interviewing the child to find out what the child wants. And it's often an advocate who's curator ad litem for a child. And then you go to court. Well, you write a report, and then you go to court on the day that it's being heard or days that it's being heard. And you got the right as a curator ad litem to, if it's an oral evidence, if it's a trial, you're allowed to cross-examine anyone, and you're allowed to, including experts. So if there's a psychologist report or a family reunification a specialist who's given a report or something like that, you're allowed to cross-examine them. Or even a medical doctor who's saying, no, this woman hasn't got schizophrenia, you can cross-examine them. You're also allowed to bring witnesses in that will support the child's view, or that you've discovered from your independent investigations. But with a curator ad litem in a children's matter, is you, your task is to have the voice of the child heard, and you can do that, and you can check, you know, you can cross-examine witnesses and that. But you're also recommending to the court, based on your investigations, what's in the best interest of the child. So often people think that because there's the voice of the child, Section 10, that is the deciding factor. And no, it's not. It's the voice of the child, but coupled with what's in the child's best interest. And so a curator ad litem's job is to tell the court, this is what the child wants, and this is what I think is in their best interest. And allowed to get your own experts and things if necessary. You obviously have to get the court's approval. But if that's what you deem is necessary, then that's what you will do.
But now you have, in that scenario, you've got a choice between the mother and the father. Now, mm-hmm. if both of them are not good, what do you do?
You've got to tell the court that, and then we start getting social workers involved and find an alternative place for them to you get a declaration in terms of Section 150 of the Children's Act that the child is in need of care, and so if both parents are hopefully are dangerous, they have to be putting the child in danger, they of harm or neglect, and then there's a Section 50 where the child becomes a child in need, and then you look around as the curator ad litem. You would be looking at, is there any other family members? Is there any, if there's no stable family member on either side that you would recommend, then you start looking at alternative placements. So would that be a child and youth care center? Would that be, do you need to put them in immediately in a place of safety? Section 150 allows a social worker, either from a child protection agency, so like the Child Welfare or Department of Social Development, to remove a child who's in immediate danger, but has to go to court with the next day. Okay. But if this is already in court, then you would sit down on urgent and say, look, this child needs to be removed, and this is where they need to be removed to. But that's that doesn't happen very often, because those things are normally there's certain people who have to report if a child is being harmed or neglected. That includes school teachers and psychologists and that. So it's unlikely to come up at court at this in this particular instance. It would have normally come up before that, and then a social worker would have already acted in terms of Section 150.
Okay.
Can I add one more thing?
Yeah.
Just, and I'm going to move away from children again, but I mentioned right at the beginning about a power of attorney, that you give an attorney to act on your behalf, and said that's a principal agent. Now, a lot of people think that a power of attorney will allow their children to make decisions for them as they get older. And that is absolutely true, but only to the point where you no longer have your own mental faculties. As soon as the principal is no longer compos mentis, as soon as they are no longer able to manage their own affairs in terms of mental capacity, and to communicate that, obviously, then they can, the power of attorney falls away, because the agent can no longer be acting on the instructions of the principal. Now, a lot of people will see that in other countries, that power of attorney, which is a simple document and easily done, is used even when a patient has dementia. And in England, for example, they have two different types of power of attorney, but the one that allows the person to act as the curator bonus equivalent of would is called an enduring power of attorney, and so that means that you act as an agent, but if the principal can't give you instructions, you can still continue acting. We don't have that in South Africa. The closest we have to that is the administrator or the curator bonus. So once you've got a power of attorney, you can go and do open bank accounts and everything, as long as the principal is still sound mind.
So this curatorship thing, How prevalent is it?
Quite. I mean, there's one that's going to court on urgent on Tuesday next week. I'm appointed as a curator ad litem. I've got to do a report within the next week to see whether the curator to appoint a curator bonus. The person's care is in jeopardy at the moment, a house needs to be sold and things. And then I was still wrapping up. I was speaking to an attorney this week that I did one just recently, where the master was asking for something on the inventory and, you know, do we include the Scottish properties or not? I've probably done, oh no, 3 or 4 a year for the last number of years. And there's often, yeah, there's normally one happening in court or so. It's quite prevalent. Not as frequent as the banks taking away people's homes and cars that they haven't paid for, but and not as often as people get divorced, but still quite frequent.
Mostly old people or people with dementia and things like that.
Mostly that, and also it's a bit of a last resort. I mean, I'm sure that the family for the one I'm doing next week would have just carried on paying what they could, or the friends, it's not family, the friends would carried on paying if they could, but you know, the patient has a house and that's just going to rack and ruin, so you're now destroying the possibility, her longevity is not affected, so we don't know how long that's going to, you know, she's going to carry on being in the state for. So we've got to sell the house and then make sure that the money from the house is going to pay for the special care that she needs for the rest of her life, however long that might be.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Is there more?
I think I'm done. Unless there's something else you wanted to know, but yeah.
No, it's a lot to think about, but it's good to understand it. Thank you.
It is my pleasure, as always.
All right.
Take care.
Take care.